It's Mark Yeagy here, wealth architect and lifestyle investor. Let's take your life to the next level. Welcome to the Wealth Architect Podcast. Hey, everybody, it's Mark Yeagy. Welcome to another episode of the Wealth Architect Podcast. So glad you're here. Today, we have a really cool guest that's going to be talking about some interesting stuff in one of my favorite subjects, which is gold. And this gentleman's been active in the precious metals market for 43 plus years. He's worked for industry giant James Blanchard, the individual most responsible for the re-legalization of private ownership of gold in 74. If you remember, and we've talked about it on this podcast, gold was outlawed for a long time, since the 1930s. And then he worked for this gentleman for 10 years in the 80s and 90s, and then he founded the American Gold Exchange in 1998. He conceived of and helped to establish the Industry Anti-Counterfeiting Task Force, which today works with the Secret Service and Homeland Security to interdict and seize counterfeit coins and bars coming into the United States from Asia. He worked with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission in their quest to end allegedly fraudulent business practices of a precious metal seller to elderly IRA investors. And that case is now pending in court. Let's just welcome Dana Samuelson and have a great conversation about gold. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here with you.
I'm so looking forward to it. Now, you are one of the seasoned fellas in gold. Now, gold's been around for thousands and maybe millions of years, and has certainly a store of value and a medium of exchange. It's been around for a long time. But why don't you tell us like kind of what you do, what your niche is, and how you got started and worked your way into what you do in physical gold?
Well, thank you. So I'm a physical precious metals dealer. We have a national mail order business here in the United States. I'm also a vintage U.S. gold and silver coin expert. The U.S. Mint made gold and silver coins as money from 1793 to 1933 in gold and all the way till the 60s in silver. So I'm also a vintage appraiser of old U.S. coins. Kind of got in the business by accident. I graduated in 1980 with a degree in German and was completely unhirable because we had high inflation, high interest rates, the economy was in the tank. Most like, you know, just about any graduate graduating in 2009, you know, very hard to get a job, similar situation. And my brother was in the coin business and I got a job working in a vault, counting, shipping and weighing bulk silver in Houston, Texas. And we handled a lot of physical silver. I got hired because I could be trusted. And a couple of years later, I got my lucky break when one of the buyers for Jim Blanchard came over to look at a silver dollar deal that we had and noticed I was a young, honest, hardworking kid. And they were looking for somebody to train as a coin appraiser. So I went to work for Jim Blanchard in 1983. That was really my career making move because I ended up becoming Jim's senior buyer, great friends with him. You know, he's the guy that was responsible for the private re-legalization of gold ownership in 1974. And after he got it done, people asked him, well, where can I buy this stuff? And he said, well, I'll sell it to you. And by 1980, he had the largest mail order coin company in the country. You know, that's on the heels of the last inflationary bout we had. And gold went from $40 in 1971 to $850 in 1980. And that created a lot of buying. And he was in the right place at the right time. So when I started my own company in 1998, I kind of modeled it on what I learned with Jim, you know, a nice mail order business to the country, competitive pricing, not reliable service, mainstream, widely traded, competitively priced products. That's all I really deal in.
Well, you're one of the OGs in the gold business and, you know, one of the purists. But what I'd like for you to do for our listeners and watchers, viewers, is to take us back through kind of the last maybe 80 years, 90 years of the history of gold. If you could tell us, you know, what has happened to gold as far as government intervention and, how it's been able to help and track and be a part of our monetary system or the lack thereof. I'd love to hear your take on the history of it.
Sure. I'll give you the cook's tour, so to speak. So I'm going to take you back to 1850.
Okay.
Let's start there. That's when the U.S. started making $20 gold coins by the U.S. Mint. And the gold price was fixed internationally at $20.67 an ounce.
Huh.
So, for example, France, Belgium, Italy, and Switzerland all had a 20-franc gold coin in 1871 because the gold price was fixed and they were all 20-franc coins. Well, Italy was 20 lira. It was a golden euro of the time. These coins were all the same size and weight, same face value, so they were interchangeably tradable country to country. Other European countries had slightly different weights to equal the face value in gold weight of their currency. Germany had a 20 mark piece, Denmark had a 20 kroner, Britain had a sovereign. These were all trading size gold coins that weighed anywhere from about a fifth of an ounce to a quarter of an ounce of gold. And that was, gold was money and currency until the 1930s, when we had the Wall Street crash of 1929 and then the Great Depression. Franklin Roosevelt was forced to do something to stabilize the economic situation. And he wanted to print more money than they could easily print gold coins. Because you can obviously print paper money much more readily than you can mine ounces of gold. So he
Sure.
confiscated the gold in the US and made gold illegal to own. Now, collector coins that had value of 15% or more above their intrinsic metal value were exempt, but the collecting market was in its infancy back then, so very few coins qualified for that. So the US took the gold out of the money. Silver remained until 1964, but the gold came out of the money, and we revalued the gold price internationally in 1935 at $35 an ounce, a 75% increase after the US confiscated it. Now, the rest of the world didn't have this issue, right? But when the gold price was revalued at $35 an ounce internationally, it basically made the gold coins of the world obsolete as currency because now their face value changed radically relative to their metal value. And that took the gold out of the money. Then we
But
have
the gold was still backed up, or the fiat currency, the paper was still backed up by the gold, right?
Then we had, World War II, obviously, following the heels of the gold just going out of the system. And then we had to decide, okay, how are we going to go forward with a monetary system? So because the US had about 21,000 tons of gold, more than the rest of the world, and was not harmed by World War II physically, and had three quarters of the world's gold supply, basically, we had enough to back our currency. It was agreed in Bretton Woods in 1945 that the dollar would become the world's reserve currency backed by gold. We would never print more more paper dollars than we had ounces of gold to back it in Fort Knox. And that made it all the way till 1971, when Richard Nixon was forced to take us off of the gold standard because primarily of the late 60s, we had inflation. We had a first wave of inflation on the back of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs, Medicare and Medicaid, the Vietnam War, and the moonshot. These were very expensive things that led to deficit spending. The US finances were in imbalance. We had empowered Germany and Japan, their manufacturing in the 50s and 60s, and they got good at it, more better at it than we were. And a lot of dollars went to these foreign countries. They had excess of them. And there was imbalances in the paper money market. Now, currencies didn't float at that point in time. They were pegged to each other, pegged to the dollar, pegged to gold. And Nixon had to break it because of imbalances that had developed for various reasons. So he did in 1971 and took us off of the gold standard. Well, gold was free to float for the first time in market price. And between 1971 and 1980, as I said, it went from about $41 an ounce to 800. And also during this time in the early 70s, currencies were allowed to float against each other for the first time after being pegged for years. So now we've got true market values on currencies against each other and commodities, the gold, oil, other things. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. We no
Interesting.
longer had, we could print the, I guess the summary is that the era of fiat currency was born in earnest in 1971.
Well, the recent one, because there's been a lot of fiat currencies in the past. But I have a question for you. What do you think? Do you think that gold was actually backed up dollar for dollar, gold for gold, or ounce for ounce from 1940, 45 to 1971? Or you think they said that it was backed up?
It was backed up in the beginning, Now, yeah. If you look at a chart of gold in Fort Knox, there's a precipitous drawdown in the late 60s when trust in the dollar being fully backed by gold began to evaporate. I mean, Charles de Gaulle famously sent a warship from France to the U.S. full of paper dollars. And when it got to New York, they converted those paper dollars into ounces of gold, which went back to France. I think that was 67 or 68, because he no longer trusted the U.S. financial system, Vietnam War primarily, and the fact that the dollars would be continue to be converted into gold. So we got down to 8,000 tons, 8,100 tons of gold by 1971. And most of that drop down from 21,000 tons to 8,000 occurred, you know, starting in about 62, 63. So it was a real sharp decline, which pushed Nixon to unpeg the dollar to gold.
I have a conspiracy theory. I think it had to do with the Beatles, but you know, that's just me.
Well, I love the Beatles.
Me too. So that's really actually fascinating. So now where are we? We're in this position where gold has been, you know, it's not backing the dollar. And now we've printed more money in the last 2 or 3 years than we printed in the entire history of the United States. Where is that taking us? What's going on here?
Well, there's a real disconnect between the amount of debt we have and reality as measured by GDP, goods and services that the world can produce. And we're seeing a widening gap between the two, which has been growing since over the last 20 years. I mean, basically, you know, we didn't have hardly any inflation in the world when gold was money and currency. And when we took the gold out of the currency, it allowed politicians to print or to spend at will. And they've done it well. They've done it exceedingly well. They're making promises that they can keep by printing money, but they couldn't keep them if we were on a hard money standard or a reasonable monetary standard where we had to have balanced checkbooks like individuals do or states do. So, you know, we're at a crossroads, I think, where we're beginning to get into a debt spiral where, you know, at $32 trillion of debt in the U.S., remember, we were only at $5 trillion in 1996. It took us 200 years to get to $5 trillion. And in less than, 27 years later, we're six times that. And when charts go vertical, from horizontal to vertical or hockey stick up, that usually means trouble. And now our interest on our debt has gone from $500 billion a year to $1 trillion. And about a third of our debt is going to reset in the next 2 years, I believe, because a lot of it's 2 to 5 year treasuries that are maturing. And these are treasuries that were issued when the interest rate was, 1% on them. You know, they're going to reset at 3 or 4%. And that's going to add another $500 billion or more to our debt. So the debt service could actually be a $1.5 trillion annually, more than military spending. And it's just going to keep growing. So something's going to break at some point in time, or the dollar is going to end up being devalued. But it's not just us. Every country has been increasing their debt. Global debt was about $220 trillion in 2014, and it's about almost $300 trillion now. So
if everybody's increasing their debt, then isn't it all okay?
Well,
I mean, it all equals out, right?
The currency's ability to buy things, though, the purchasing power of fiat currencies are losing relative to tangible assets.
That's right.
And that's why the gold price is higher. It's not that gold's gaining. It's that paper money is actually losing. You've got to turn that chart upside down. So the purchasing power of the dollar, the yen, the euro, the yuan, they're all diminishing. And especially against tangible assets like real estate, gold. Oil is underperforming right now, but there's some shenanigans going on in the oil market right now. And it's economic as much as anything else. We just have to see how China reacts. You know, we've got the BRICS nations are threatening to create their own currency of some kind. And Saudi Arabia, let me get this right, Brazil, Russia, India, Saudi Arabia, and China. And 18 or 20 other nations are going to vote pretty quickly here on whether they're going to be in the BRICS. And that is 50% or more of the population with 60% or more of the natural resources. If they decide they want to have their own euro, which they might, or it could be the yuan to compete with the dollar as the world's reserve currency, it's going to rearrange things. And it's possible that it could be partially backed by gold.
I completely agree. And it's countries like Iran that are getting part of this, are becoming part of this coalition. And you know, things that you would have 5 years ago, nobody would have ever believed that Iran would be backing or a part of a new reserve currency. But we did it to ourselves. Wouldn't you agree that, you know, when we put sanctions on Russia and we said, hey, we can just take your money. We don't like your politics. We don't like your wars. We're just going to take your money. Other countries, I think, kind of went, wait a minute. They raised an eyebrow and said, wait a minute, they can do it to them. Can't they do it to us? What do you think?
Oh, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. You know, having world reserve currency status, most people think it's economic, but it's actually about power.
Sure it is.
We've been benevolent with our power as the world's reserve currency status. I mean, we haven't actually been benevolent. You know, you talk to a few South American dictators over the years, they may not agree from their graves. But when we sanctioned Russia following the Ukraine war, that's exactly what happened. Everyone on the eastern side of the world said, hey, if they've done it to them, they can do it to us. And, you know, China is like the big brother to Russia right now, egging Russia on, you know, so they don't get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
But it's helping to achieve China's aims, which are to increase the market share of the yuan, increase the divide between the east to west. You know, we've denied China access to the world's most sophisticated chip making machine, which comes out of the Netherlands, and they can't make the really high-end computer chips without it. And we've also banned Huawei from having their chips here in the United States. Those are both things that happened last year. But more importantly, and this I think is really where most people will get it, is Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. You know,
Henry Kissinger helped to create the petrodollar, which made dollars proliferate around the world in 1974 after the Israeli war, where we sided with Israel and the Arab nations created an oil boycott on the U.S. Henry Kissinger went to Saudi Arabia and said, hey, look, if you'll, we'll protect you. Don't worry about it. We'll protect you if you'll price oil in dollars. We helped Aramco build their wells over there and their whole financial infrastructure. And Aramco goes back to 1935. And that lasted all well until 2008, 2009, 2010. Then we get into the debt printing, you know, the money printing. But more importantly, MBS became the de facto ruler over there. And we sanctioned him for the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, right?
Yep.
And in 2016, the U.S., because of the shale industry here in oil, became self-sufficient. We actually exported oil. So what were we? We were no longer Saudi Arabia's best customer. And now we have antagonized their ruler. So what did they do last year? This year at Davos? They said for the first time they would agree to take other currencies in lieu of dollars and for oil.
Yep.
They've also... China is their best customer. They're exporting more oil to China than they are to the U.S. and Europe combined. Number two. And number three, they're making massive investments in petrochemical facilities, two or three of that I know of in China, right? So there's a long-term pivot from Saudi Arabia, from the West to the East.
Yep.
And that, I think, is more indicative of anything. And they want to be a BRICS nation now, or they are a BRICS nation.
It's amazing. And the way you put it with Saudi Arabia being the pivotal story here, I think is really important. And it takes me back. I've studied 700 currencies or so, you know, through some of my mentors and all that stuff. And none of them have ever ended positively. And then when you look at the reserve currencies, you can go back to the last one, which was the pound. And then the ones before that, which were France and Britain and the Netherlands and things like that. France and the Netherlands, I should say. And they've all ended after, you know, 100 or so years. We're at 75 years or something as the world's, you know, reserve currency. And I think we're blowing it, right? I think it's the irresponsibility of what we do domestically and also internationally that makes us feel like we're blowing it. So my question to you, I guess, would be, you know, so you believe in hard assets. Are there other hard assets besides gold, or you think gold is the one to own? Hey, it's Mark Yeagy, author of this book, Uncovered Calls, here to tell you about my cash flow machine trading program that's designed to show you how I make safe, reliable income. Now, I shoot for 2 to 4% a month of income in my portfolio, and we have courses to teach you how to do this yourself or inside a mastermind community. And the best part of it is that it only takes me about 20 minutes a week, maybe to an hour to implement. Now, while 2 to 4% a month may not sound like much, I show you exactly how I took my IRA from $111,000 to over $700,000 in just 23 months without huge risk. Yes, I got a little lucky, I gotta say, but I'm not telling you this to brag, just to show you that you could do this too. So to learn more about this program, go to cashflowmachine.io, or better yet, go to this link to get access to videos and masterclasses that explain the entire process, the risks and rewards even more. See you there.
Well, the traditional four precious metals are gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. Gold is the currency of last resort. Central banks are buying it at record levels. They were net sellers between 1980 and 2010 and have become net buyers since 2010. So when central banks, the most conservative bankers in the world, you know, change their pattern, that's got to tell you something. I think they're slowly accumulating gold to hedge their bets against currency defaults or treasury defaults by other nations. They may be preparing for something bigger, a gold backing of a currency partially. I don't know. But it's a major shift. Now, silver could be considered spending money in a crisis because sure. It has a much lower denomination than gold, where gold is true, portable, transferable wealth. What gold really has, and this is something your listeners should be most cognizant of, is no counterparty risk. It has no counterparty risk. It's an asset unto itself. Its value is recognized universally around the world. It's immediately liquid. And its value is not contingent upon a party to a transaction performing, whether it's a mortgagee paying the rent or a stock for a company, you know, making a profit. You know, it has no counterparty risk. So that's what gold is for. And that's why central banks are buying. It's compact wealth. Silver takes up a lot more room, but it could be conceived of as spending money in a crisis. Platinum and palladium are much more industrial related metals. Palladium is many times scarcer than platinum. Platinum is scarcer than gold. They both come out of South Africa and Russia. They're in short supply right now, but they're much more economically related. So I focus mostly on gold and silver.
So, you know, we started by talking about how gold was confiscated and gold is kind of the safe haven with no counterparty risk, but there is some government risk, right? Can't they come in and confiscate it again like they did in 35?
Potentially, but remember, gold was money back in the day. People had a choice between a $20 gold piece or a $20 paper note, and they didn't trust the government because of what was going on. So they wanted the gold. They were hoarding it. That's why gold had to come out of the currency. Today, you know, in the U.S., maybe 5% of the public actually owns gold. You know, so if we get to the point where it's a consideration, it's going to be because there's a lot of other bad things happening. Yeah. And it's probably going to be number 10, 20, or 30 on the list. And remember, gold was never confiscated anywhere else in the world, ever. Right. And the U.S. Mint has been in the business of making gold bullion coins since 1986. They're making them today. So they're sellers of gold. That would be another abrupt about face, you know, if that were to happen. But I don't think it's going to be something that most people should worry about. I don't think anyone should really worry about it, to be honest with you. Not now, anyway. Could change.
Dana, what do you think about the government's pivot to a CBDC, a central bank digital currency? How is that going to affect hard assets like gold?
CBDCs are just, instead of having bank accounts, it'll be like we all have a credit card today. We're all trained to use credit cards.
Yep.
Only instead of being something that has a debt or a debit card attached to it, it'll be related to our bank account and the government can move money in and out of it. What it does is it creates problems for social tracking, right?
Sure.
Potentially the government can see everything you do. And if you do something that is not deemed politically correct, you could get social negative points or social positive points if you're acting in the way they want you to. And just as easily as they put money into your account, they could take it out. So these are some of the considerations with CBDCs. I do think we're going to have them. It's inevitable. I do think that there will be for a while, you know, kind of an underground market for paper money. If it's taken out of current, you know, consideration, they're going to have a transition phase.
I don't see how that's going to happen, but
yeah. And I don't know. It's a really big equation, and that may be a little above my pay grade, but I am concerned about the social tracking. Number one, for gold and silver, you know, I don't think it'll make that much difference in the short term. It may make a drive into them, to be honest with you. No, but more importantly, can I go off to another topic?
Yeah, sure.
Now, more importantly with gold, and this is another consideration. Now, one of the reasons we had the petrodollar, all those dollars went out into the world. How did they come back into the U.S.? They came back into the U.S. by the Saudis buying our treasuries.
Yes.
Right? We had to have a mechanism to get those dollars back. Well, if the Chinese yuan is going to become a much more prominent currency in the world, which it will, they don't have a free-floating market. They don't have transparency in their markets. They don't have a bond market that we can invest in. But what they have created is the exchange of gold for yuan via the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which will allow people that have excess yuan to convert it into gold. So it makes it a way for yuan to come back to China and for those sellers of yuan to take gold off. And that's going to create a lot more demand for gold. So gold here, we don't have a golden tradition in the United States like Asia does, like Europe does, because our currency has never failed, right? Like currencies and governments have failed over there. It hasn't happened yet, but the potential for that to, you know, is growing.
I think it's just slowly failing, but you know, I digress a little bit. We've already defaulted on the dollar. It's just we're doing it through inflation, which is something that happens in slow motion. You know, one fact that I always hear is, you know, 100 years ago, it took an ounce of gold to buy one really nice Italian suit. Today, it takes 1 ounce of gold to buy one really nice Italian suit. So I just want to kind of emphasize that, you know, it's the denominator in the equation, the fiat currency that underlies the value of gold. So gold holds its value and the denominator declines in value. And so gold seemingly goes up. So it is a safe haven when you relate it to other assets. The one question that I have to ask you, because if you've listened to my podcast or whatever, watched any of them, you know that I'm a Bitcoin guy as well. And so I've got to ask you the Bitcoin question. It seems to me that Bitcoin has just one advantage over gold. Now, gold has an advantage that you can hold it and touch it, which can be good or bad because you can't go cross borders if you're taking all your wealth in gold and there's a confiscatory border. On the other hand, if you have Bitcoin, you can just store the keys in your brain and you can walk across a border and you can, you know, cash it in somewhere else in a fiat currency in another part of the world. So it's digital gold in one respect, and then gold has some other advantages in the other respect. What do you think? You think they can coexist?
Well, they do coexist. They are coexisting. I agree with you completely. Gold has no counterparty risk. You can hold it and touch it. You don't need a power supply for it to work properly. Right? Bitcoin has a unique and different set of benefits, which is you can move money over borders very easily with Bitcoin, and you can't do it with gold, just like you can't do it with paper money or sometimes with money in the bank.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin does offer that benefit, which is a huge benefit. Price volatility scares me a bit, but it's settling down now after, you know, becoming much more mainstream over the last 10 years. So it does have some volatility. That's still working its way out.
Sure.
Gold is more stable, but Bitcoin, there's nothing that can touch it for moving money over borders.
And in a very inexpensive fashion and very quickly too, with the the layer one, layer two networks that are developing on top of it, like the Lightning Network. So interesting to hear somebody that's so into gold talking that Bitcoin is going to be coexisting, because it does. You're absolutely right. And I think there's a place for it. And there's a scarcity component, just like there is with gold. Although one of the arguments is that you can always make more gold if gold gets more expensive. You know, they'll find a way to pull more gold out of the earth, depending on the price. But you know, there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoin. But I think they do coexist, and I think they're actually fungible against each other as well over time, especially as fiat currencies continue to get worse. Wow. I mean, you and I pretty much agree on everything. Like, I wanted to make this controversial, but like, we're agreeing on everything. So that's fantastic. So what have I not asked you? What would you like to say that that is important for an investor to consider when they're looking at gold to either add to their portfolio or to start a gold portfolio?
Well, what gold really is for most people, it's an insurance policy for the rest of their assets, their finances, right?
Exactly.
You should have some, and any financial planner worth their salt will tell you should have 5 or 10%. The World Gold Council has done a study going back about 20 or 30 years, and they say the sweet spot is 6 to 8% of assets in precious metals, whether that's gold or silver or a mix. It gives you enough of a counterbalance, a hedge against uncertainty, inflation, devaluation, where you don't lose opportunity in other sectors. And what people should think of it as, especially in an inflationary period like what we're going through now, is a way to save your hard-earned money outside of the dollar, which is just losing money due to devaluation. It's a savings account out of the financial system that gives you liquidity whenever you need it. Like, I think real estate's a great investment. It's a great inflation hedge. It can produce returns, but it is not always liquid. And what's happening now that we've had some bank failures, bankers are tightening up their lending standards dramatically, right? So it's harder to get a loan now. But with gold, you always have liquidity. And gold worked perfectly during the last financial crisis of 2008. It more than doubled in value between 2008 and 2011, when most everything else was falling in value 50% or more. So sure, you may not be happy you have it for a period of time. It may not do that much, but when you need it, you really need it. And if you look at gold price appreciation over the last 20 years or 23 years since 2000, in every major world currency, on average, it's gained 6, 7, 8, 9% a year, depending upon the currency. Now, it's lumpy. It doesn't do that every year consistently. It can gain 25% a year and then lose 15% the next. So it's lumpy. But on average, it's gaining at the more than the inflation rate and gaining about the same rate as inflation. And it is harder to get it out of the ground than you realize.
Well, there's a whole other conversation, that goes along with that. But what is the statistic that all the gold that's ever been taken out of the ground in the earth, you can fill up like 3 or 5 Olympic sized swimming pools, right?
I think it's actually less than that, but yeah, it's not a lot when you look at it.
Pretty scarce.
Yeah, it's really dense, but it doesn't take up that much room. And most of the gold that has ever been mined does survive.
Yes.
But every year there's more and more and more people. So the pie, it stays the same while the people who want to eat the pie just keeps getting a little bigger every year.
Yes. Yeah. And so that brings me to another question, and that is costs of having gold, storing gold, and you mentioned there's a lot of liquidity with it. But there is some slippage when it comes to getting in and out. Can you talk about those three things?
Right. So I'm in the physical market. I deal with modern minted sovereign bullion products made by the U.S. Mint, the Royal Canadian Mint, the Austrian Mint, South African Mint, also private refineries in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. These entities do not make an ounce of gold to exacting standards for free. There's a minting charge. There's a distribution charge, there's insurance, there's a profit to the distributor who buys them in bulk from the mints, and then there's a profit to me as a secondary dealer who does business with the distributor. So the net buy-sell spread on a competitively priced ounce of gold is about 4%. It is not it has some friction. So it's not a transaction where you want to be in and out as a trading vehicle. There are ETFs where you can buy gold and silver on paper if you want to harness the price movement of gold or silver up or down, if you can short them, that are much more effective that way. But there's nothing like holding the physical metal yourself when you have it, because it's private, it's outside of the system, you can transfer it easily to the next person. So there is friction within the transaction for physical gold that you don't have with most stocks or bonds. So it's something, if you're going to buy it, you should just hold it as your savings account of last resort. If you really need it, it is liquid, but there are physical restrictions on, you know, the value up and down. Yep, you know, right now gold's about 1950. It's got to go up about $80 an ounce just for you to break even. There's also storage fees if you want to store at an independent warehouse. Or you can store at home if you like with a home safe. So there's a little bit of risk. Gold doesn't take up a lot of room. You can hide it pretty easily. You know, 100 ounces is about the size of a paperback novel. It weighs about 8 pounds. You can carry it around in your pockets and nobody know you would have it. It's $200,000, right? Or 195,000 right now.
Right.
Sorry. But so it's portable and it's easy to store that way, but it is a risk. So you've got to have someplace you can store it. You can also get insurance on it, but you're not going to get reasonably priced insurance from your major insurance companies. We have some niche companies we work with who this is their specialty for storage and insurance as well. So I can recommend that to people if they like individually.
And just for perspective for the listeners and viewers, when you transact with a credit card, there's a 3% slippage fee that you don't see as the consumer, but the vendor is paying that. So if you spend that over and over again, that same $100, it becomes 97 and then less than 94. And then pretty soon you've whittled away that money and it's gone to Visa and MasterCard and American Express. So gold is not too far away from that. There's some value in having somebody like you provide gold to people and providing that liquidity. I always believe that you pay people to provide the liquidity. You shouldn't punish them. So it's good that you can make money on that. So just trying to give a little perspective that, you know, there's a cost of doing business here. And like you say, it's not something you're going to spend all the time. It is more of a store of value and kind of an insurance policy. You don't complain about your insurance, your house. You don't complain about the insurance policy that you paid for when your house burns down. You're happy that you did it.
Right. But with insurance, there's a repeating charge, you know,
that's right.
You know, monthly, annually, whatever. When you have your gold insurance, you have that policy. You don't have to do it again every 6 months or a year.
Yeah.
So that's something to consider as well.
Right. Fascinating stuff, Dana. Anything else you'd like to leave our viewers and listeners with? This has been really kind of a great history lesson and a great lesson in economics too. And people really need to pay attention to macro. And then in their own personal environment, they need to pay attention to their micro environment as well by buying some gold. So what would you like to leave us with? Because I think it's great.
Well, you know, we're in a challenging environment, a more challenging environment than we've been in quite a while because of this dramatic surge in interest rates. We've already seen some bank failures and it's not over yet. We have $1.5 trillion of commercial real estate that's been mortgaged to banks around the country that it's going to be problematic over the next year or so.
Yep.
It's a bigger problem than some of the other banks that have already failed, which, by the way, the bank failures that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 months are more than we had in the last financial crisis combined.
Yep.
So there's systemic fragility within the banking system that most people don't realize. So be wary of that. And you really need to pay attention. And, you know, gold is an excellent way to hedge your bet a little bit. Silver, too. You know, we're a national mail order company. We have online transparent pricing. We believe in consultative sales. We help people discuss what they want to do and really trying to help them because our business is based on repeat business and referrals. And if you take good care of people, you know, they'll come back and do more business with you.
Yeah.
We really want to try and help you if we can. That's really, I think, the most succinct way I can put it.
Where can we go to get that help?
My company's American Gold Exchange. Our website is AmerGold amergold.com. If you send an email to info@amergold.com, that's a good way to get a conversation started. Records completely private. You know, we really just want to try and help people. And, you know, as you said at the top of the show, I've given back by, you know, helping to establish the anti-counterfeiting task force and also helping the CFTC put a really egregious, allegedly egregious dealer out of business. And I've done some other things for the CFTC quietly that I really can't talk about, because it's a way to give back and trying to help and protect people.
Yeah. Well, that's what it's all about at the end of the day, is how much you can help other people. And that's why you and I are talking, I think. So listen, thank you so much for the history lesson, at least for me, and reaffirming some of the things that I knew, and learned a couple new things as well. And maybe for me and the listeners the same. And I appreciate your time, your wisdom. And listen, if you send info@amergold.com, get a conversation started with Dana. I think it's a super way to get your money out of the crazy banks that if you just leave it in there, you're losing 10 to 20% a year in buying power. You might as well put it in something that's going to hold it and maybe have some increase in scarcity or increase in value due to scarcity and maybe protect your portfolio. So thank you so much, Dana. I appreciate it. And as I always say to all my listeners and viewers, never give up your power and your health, your wealth, or your time. So I'll see you next time on the Wealth Architect Podcast. Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to the Wealth Architect Podcast with Mark Yeagy. Follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Like and subscribe on YouTube. Share and tell your friends. See you soon.